endorsing selected environmental policy initiatives. This is actually part of two parts of this. It's part of developing the policy initiatives part, as well as weekly recommendations to the board, and also communicating to the board, to the public, us, basically what the board has in mind. The document that actually initiates EPAC is a county advisory committee. There is the line, promoting greener community involvement in local environmental issues and local government programs dealing with these issues. Fulfillment of that role that EPAC holds these community conversations from time on, is like the fifth or the sixth of one of these that we have. As you may know, BOCC has set for itself a task of lowering the amount of waste which is sent to our landfill. And that is an environmentally sound policy. Tonight we have asked five panelists, one who isn't here yet, Harvey Ward, bless you, Harvey. Everyone of these people is very, very knowledgeable in their individual fields to help us understand the problems, the pitfalls we can expect to encounter if we choose to limit the amount of plastic and styrofoam, polystyrene, that we allow to go into the landfill. Before I introduce the monitor for tonight's forum, I have a couple of brief announcements. First, we'll be having a 10-minute break. What about the halfway point? You good? Although she can call, one any other time. There's a bathroom outside, right outside, down the hall, across the hall from here. Also, water there if you need that. Feel free to get up at any time and take advantage of that. And second, Forgive me, I'm going to use a cheat sheet for this. I had a Benadryl to deal with allergies that I have, so I wouldn't. We can still be on the first line if I didn't have this. Tonight's moderator is Nina Bhattacharya. Nina is a natural resource specialist with USDA, Natural Resources Conservation Service. She has a Bachelor of Science from the University of Richmond, with a Fulbright Scholar, that's impressive, and holds a Master of Environmental Management from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Nina?
Well, so welcome to the audience and panelists. Thank you so much for attending. Before we get started, we are collecting emails at the front, and the city and county are putting together a joint email list to let everyone know when workshops like this are going on, and other information. So let Sally know to check off if you were willing to be added to that email list. So there's been a lot of discussion about single-use plastic bag ban and a polystyrene ban in our community. And as many of you all know, bans of this nature have been sweeping across the country, from California to Texas to Maine, and also around the world. Kenya has passed a single-use plastic bag ban. Taiwan and France have passed bans on single-use plastic bags, utensils, cups, and straws. And the EU is also considering a ban on single-use plastic items. If you do a search of these bans online, you'll see that a lot of communities are having very similar discussions that we are today, whether to ban single-use plastic items or what alternative products are out there that we may consider. And whether it's looking at the environmental impacts or economic impacts, it can be very complicated. It's really important to mention also that this discussion is part of a larger zero-waste movement, one that is intended to move society away from what some have coined a throwaway culture, using items once and discarding them, to one that uses products again and again in a closed-loop system. So the discussion tonight will focus on whether the county should consider banning or charging a fee on single-use plastic bags and polystyrene containers. And it will be an opportunity for our panelists to provide information and their knowledge on this issue and to break down any preconceived notions. So we're going to ask a few questions that are in about four different categories, just providing general information and background, looking at government infrastructure and regulations, looking at the business side of things and economics, and then also solutions and recommendations. So I'm going to introduce our panelists. First, we have Daniel Penniman. He's a land use planning biologist with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. He holds a bachelor's degree in resource economics and a master's degree in interdisciplinary ecology with a specialization in environmental engineering sciences, both from the University of Florida. Daniel has worked as a professional ecologist for 8 years, performing various biological field investigations in terrestrial and aquatic ecosystems throughout Florida. Through his work, he has witnessed the inescapable presence and impacts from plastic and styrene waste in natural ecosystems. He looks forward to discussing the ongoing work of FWC and participating in this forum to move us closer to innovative ideas and cost-effective solutions for reducing these environmental pollutants.
Use the microphone.
Next we have testing. Next we have Dr. Timothy Townsend. He is a professor in the Department of Environmental Engineering Sciences in the Engineering School for Sustainable Infrastructure and in the Environment at the University of Florida. He has a BS, ME, and PhD in Environmental Engineering Sciences from the University of Florida. Dr. Townsend teaches and conducts research related to solid and hazardous waste management. His courses cover subjects such as waste management fundamentals, landfill design, recycling, construction, and demolition debris, and waste management in developing countries. He has published many papers and reports on topics related to bioreactor landfills, recycling, and environmental implications of construction and demolition debris. Next we have Matt Williams. Matt is the director of UF's Office of Sustainability and Energy Integration. He holds a BS and MS in Wildlife Ecology and Conservation from the University of Florida, and has been a certified energy auditor through the Association of Energy Engineers. Prior to joining the office at UF, Matt worked for 7 years in the Office of Sustainability at Auburn University in Alabama, where he was the lead coordinator for Auburn's first climate action plan and supporting greenhouse gas inventories. Matt's approach recognizes the combined roles of individuals and institutions in creating a sustainable future and the need for higher education to take a leadership role in both educating students for sustainability and incorporating sustainability practices into day-to-day campus operations. And next we have Joel Islam. He is the president and COO of Florida Food Service, a family-owned and operated food service distributor. He holds a BS in Business Administration and Finance from the University of Florida. Joel began his career with Florida Food Service in 1980. He held positions in operations, customer service, purchasing, sales, and administration. He became a shareholder in 1994, and in 2004, he became president and COO of Florida Food Service. Joel is married and has 2 children. So next up, I would like to provide the mic to our panelists and give an opening remark.
Sorry. I first want to thank everybody for coming tonight. And then I also want to let you guys know I'm here with my colleague, Sean Green. He'll be helping me answer questions and providing contact information for any contact information that is requested from us. I did have a presentation, a visual. Our technologies, we're not able to show it. The first thing I'm gonna say is our FWC's mission statement is managing fish and wildlife for their benefit and for the benefit of people. This is a very important task for us. FWC is an agency with research staff who implement science-based natural resource management. Multiple FWC staff and programs recognize the threat of plastics and polystyrene debris to fish and wildlife and their habitats. My presentation frames the issue of their impacts from plastic and polystyrene waste by pulling from peer-reviewed research and comments by FWC's staff, subject matter experts. I will provide some introductory information on what is known about plastic and polystyrene debris in our natural ecosystems. I'll detail the primary ways in which plastic and styrene waste impacts fish and wildlife. That was on the ways are there on the slide. And then finally provide a suite of examples of how our agency is working to curb and impact the plastic and polystyrene debris on how we're working to curb the impacts on wildlife and ecosystems. For some current information, plastic and polystyrene items and debris are now found in terrestrial, freshwater, and marine ecosystems throughout the world, including deep ocean trenches. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, The most commonly found consumer plastic and polystyrene products are cigarette butts, food wrappers, beverage bottles, straws, cups and plates, bottle caps, and single-use plastic bags. Research and advocacy regarding plastic and polymer debris almost exclusively focuses on marine ecosystems, with little attention on freshwater and terrestrial systems. That's an important thing to remember because there is a large gap of research in this area on freshwater and terrestrial ecosystems. Most marine litter debris comes from upland sources when mishandled materials are blown by the wind or washed into waterways through stormwater. This can take debris from upland and inland places like Alachua County, carry it to ocean into the ocean or other water bodies. Some research quantifies the amount of plastics deposited in oceans from rivers, and the findings indicate that rivers contribute substantially. I'll now expand a little bit on the main impacts to fish and wildlife from plastic and polystyrene debris. The first way is in through ingestion and contamination. Reports of harmful interaction between wildlife and debris items are numerous. It is estimated that over 100 million marine animals are killed each year due to plastic debris in the ocean. Scientific literature and feedback from FWC personnel indicates that pieces of plastic and polystyrene have been identified in the gut contents of numerous species during necropsies. Observations and laboratory studies have shown that consumption of plastics and polystyrene debris can interfere with feeding and digestion and reproduction in many aquatic species. This has been observed in a large number of birds, but also in zooplankton and the organisms that make up the base of the food chain. FWC has found plastic and polystyrene debris in the stomach contents of species in Alachua County, including bears, coyotes, alligators, freshwater turtles, and birds. A recent study by FWC scientists document the impacts of marine debris on manatees. Plastic debris has directly caused the death of manatees, and from 2008 to 2012, approximately 18% of manatees examined had foreign objects in their digestive tracts. The most common were monofilament fishing line, but plastic bags, balloons, and other household items were also found. And then recent findings also determine that micropolystyrene exposure in adult oysters affects feeding as well as growth offspring. So again, those are laboratory studies that are showing that. Additionally, debris items can also act as a source for environmental contaminants. Due to characteristics of plastic and styrene materials, they can release additives as well as accumulate waterborne contaminants that already exist in the aquatic environment. Some of the contaminants include metals and persistent bioaccumulative and toxic compounds. A recent lab study demonstrated the trophic transfer of contaminants from microplastics along the food web from mussels to crabs. Again, that's a laboratory study. And another recent experimental study demonstrated that fish exposed to contaminants which readily attach to microplastics can bioaccumulate these substances and suffer adverse effects such as liver toxicity. I can go into what some of those substances are later on. But currently, there is a great deal of debate about the extent which plastic and polystyrene debris facilitate this transfer of contaminants to wildlife and humans on a significant scale. That's very important. There's lab studies showing that, but there's still a great amount of research to show or to identify whether these contaminants are passed from plastics to wildlife and to humans on a large scale. There's a lot of debate about that. Another major way that plastics and polystyrene debris can impact wildlife is through entanglement and injury. A variety of species have been found entangled or trapped in plastic debris, resulting in impaired movement, and, impaired feeding, reduced reproductive output, lacerations, ulcers, and death. Again, that FWC research on manatees showed that between 1993 and 2012, entanglement was the number one human cause reason for manatee rescue. The main entanglement was monofilament line, so there's not great amount of information on the impacts of bags on and polystyrene containers on entanglement issues. And then the third major way that polystyrene impact and plastic debris impacts wildlife is through the alteration of important habitats. Plastic and polystyrene waste affect wildlife through the alteration of habitat. Excessive amounts of plastic and styrene waste can change the physical and chemical characteristics of ecosystems. A published study showed that marshland sediments covered with plastic bags had far lower oxygen levels and numbers of macroinvertebrates than sediments that remained bag-free. Additionally, as plastic waste accounts for approximately 30% or up to 30% of landfill space worldwide, natural habitats may be impacted to expand facilities and to manage and contain trash. And then now quickly, I will just run through some examples of FWC's efforts to curb the impacts of plastic and polystyrene debris in the environment. As a note, these efforts focus more broadly than just on single-use packaging materials, but I want to demonstrate some example that there are other ways that plastics and polystyrenes are affecting the environment, and it's not just through packaging materials. FWC staff has worked in partnership with staff from federal agencies, local governments, NGOs, and universities, and private industry to develop the Florida Marine Debris Removal Guidance Plan, a guidance document to tackling the main contributors to marine debris. FWC staff performs research on impacts to managed species, such as manatees and turtles, specifically the impacts of waste or of debris issues. FWC's monofilament recovery and recycling program helps to deploy bins to collect and remove fishing line that can injure wildlife. FWC often supports trash cleanups in various ecosystems by attending with staff and vessels and providing educational materials. FWC provides funding to local governments to assist with securing residential and commercial trash in heavy bare areas. One significant pathway for plastic and styrene debris to enter the environment is through waste management system. And so FWC is assisting local counties, if they want, to help them provide funding for better secure trash cans and residential trash cans and commercial trash cans. And then FWC is encouraging the use of wildlife-friendly materials and erosion control practices. In Alachua County alone, FWC has confirmed instances of several state and federally listed species becoming entangled in plastic and sod netting, including eastern indigo snakes, gopher tortoises, and wood storks. And that's all I have to contribute at this point.
Good evening. Again, I'm Tim Townsend. I'm in the College of Engineering here at University of Florida. Been there over 20 years, and I study garbage. I don't specifically study polystyrene or plastic bags, but certainly that's part of our waste stream, and I'm happy to share my thoughts on insights with regard to that. I also want to say that I think we're fortunate in Alachua County that the Board of County Commissioners and the Public Works Department has been working on kind of advanced technologies, going I think above and beyond what most counties in the state of Florida do with respect to solid waste management. Sally Palmy here is the solid waste director. They've been funding research and working with students for several decades, trying to figure out what's the best way to manage solid waste in Alachua County and beyond. Now, you may or may not know this, but the state of Florida has a 75% recycling goal. This was established in 2008 by the Florida legislature. So there's a statute out there that says Florida should reach 75% by 2020. In case you haven't heard the news, we're not going to reach 75% by 2020. There's a lot of reasons for that. I don't want to digress too much from the primary materials we're talking about tonight, but this is a big topic in the state of Florida. It's a big topic in the country right now. It's a big topic internationally. You've probably seen on the news or read stories that China has recently closed down a lot of the recycling markets, including for a lot of plastics. That's making it much more challenging to recycling some of the materials that we're used to recycling. That's not to say there aren't still recycling markets out there, but they're more challenging to find and you get less money back. So the cost of recycling in many parts of the state and many parts of the country, it's going up. One of the things that the University of Florida is doing right now is we're working, in addition to working with local governments like Alachua County, we're working with the State Florida Department of Environmental Protection, FDEP, about what to do next. What to do next means, okay, if we're not going to get to 75%, what's an appropriate set of objectives that we can follow? One of the things that, time permitting and question permitting, that we can talk about is that what we're really starting to focus back on is, okay, recycling is good. We want to try to recycle, but we also want to try to recycle smart. What is the best way to recycle in the smartest way possible to meet our objectives? Now, what are your objectives? Well, everybody's different. For some of you, that might be greenhouse gas emissions and your carbon footprint, or it might be the amount of energy used, or it might be water usage. I think a big one that's drawn all of you here is, of course, this terrible problem of plastics getting into the environment and the oceans. So there's a lot of different objectives, but how do we target the materials that we manage in the smartest way we can? One of the things that we can do to try to make those decisions is we can use new science that gives us a better idea of the impacts of managing different materials in different ways. And you might have heard of a term at some point called a life cycle assessment or a life cycle analysis, but the idea is that we begin to look at materials not just when we throw them away, but when from the point they're manufactured all the way to that they're thrown away, or better yet, to be reused in something else. In preparation for the meeting today, I did review some of the polystyrene disposable cup LCAs which are out there, and a little bit on the plastic bag. So I can certainly try to share my understanding of what I understand some of the science to be. And the answers aren't always real straightforward, and I'll try to give you the best overview of that I can. But I guess the one thing I'd leave you with is that, in addition to considering specific materials, I think we're at a unique point in the county and the state about trying to figure out what's the next best way to really manage our waste stream and our materials. And so there's a lot of science and there's a lot of efforts. One of the things we're doing with Sally right now is we're hoping to do a countywide materials management inventory. In other words, not just looking at the garbage that's there and the waste that's there and what's recycled and how to do more of that, but what are our choices that we make in terms of materials that we use and how does that impact our environment as a whole? So I'll leave it at that and happy to participate in the discussion.
I do want to introduce City Commissioner Harvey Ward. And invite him up to the panel.
You're not going to make Harvey speak immediately upon getting up to the table?
Whatever is good.
Yeah. Good evening. I'm Matt Williams with the University of Florida's Office of Sustainability. Been working on sort of broad-reaching sustainability for more than a decade now, and this is just one of the many areas. One of the places that I will speak to this evening is the university's efforts towards zero waste. In 2005, the university established a zero waste goal for 2015. Much like Tim mentioned, for the state-level goal, the university did not meet that. But at the same time, the diversion rates that the university sees are somewhere around 45%, excluding construction and demolition waste. And for those who don't regularly speak in these terms, we do it all by weight. And so for each plastic bottle that you recycle, there's very little weight with that. For every piece of concrete, there's a heck of a lot more weight. So we exclude construction and demolition. But 44% for a campus of that size is pretty admirable, we think. As an example, University of California, Berkeley is at 43%. And so it's both the willpower of the community as well as what's available in the local community as well. And Tim made mention about what the county here has been able to provide. And it's only because of what Alachua County provides, because all waste within the county bounds does essentially get processed by the Alachua County facility. That's what allows other entities, other institutions to be able to do what they do. Now, having said that, the university's goal towards zero waste, and that included a styrofoam ban in dining in 2011, and in 2012, a ban of plastic bags in dining facilities as well. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a second here, but the university is not able to create a zero waste community on its own. It's dependent upon all the rest of the entities, the county, the municipality, the private partners that we have. The university is probably the largest composting entity in the county, would be my guess. What's that? The only composting entity in the county. We compost about 1 million pounds of food waste on an annual basis and have been doing so since 2014. And that's with a private partner that does construction and demolition waste and then also composting as well. So a lot goes into it. But one of the things in this conversation around what the city and the county do as well is the recognition that it takes an enormous amount of time And it takes an enormous amount of compromise, creativity, and different kinds of meetings. As an example, I had an hour and a half long meeting about those little colored tops on toothpicks when we were doing composting in the football stadium. Because something like that, if you were to buy a composted product to put down in your garden, you wouldn't necessarily want a green frill or a blue frill next to your pansies. Turns out, yes, that is cellulosic-based plastic, and that does break down. But that's the kind of level, when you start talking about zero plastics, that you will get down into the level of discussion about. So it's not just the large-scale products that we're talking about, but every way that you see that. And as Daniel mentioned as well, when you start talking about the impact of microplastics on wildlife, those are the ones that really have a large potential impact on it as well. So the university was able to eliminate styrofoam in 2011 and bags in 2012. I mentioned only in dining facilities because of the large-scale dining contract that the university's been in for over 20 years. And that's one of the things that makes it different from the university standpoint than it would with the small business providers that Joel's company and others may be working with as well. And there's a difference in what the university's been able to do and what small entities may be able to do. Because we're able to leverage the purchasing power of Aramark Corporate at a national scale to allow it to benefit the university. So for example, when the university did eliminate styrofoam, there was a slight cost increase going from styrofoam to what we all know is the paper cups with kind of a wax coating on them. So there was a cost increase in that. They wanted to raise the price of drinks by about 10 cents a piece for that. When the university moved from those, because those are not compostable, to a compostable product cup, the cost was actually very negligible. And part of that, and I'm probably the last person to support corporate sponsorships and vendor connections and things like that, but it's actually through the university's relationship with Pepsi that that was allowable, because they were able to provide a cup that worked for all the different vendors on campus as well. So again, this is something that took the university, this was established in 2005 that the university started down this pathway. Most of those things went into place in 2011, 2012. So it takes a large number of years with a large interested community to be able to figure some of this out. And some of the examples that the university's come up with, like I mentioned, may or may not apply at the city and the county level at the small scale business provider, or for those that have large scale distribution networks that are gonna be different from ours. I'll also mention, as Tim talked about here, the embodied energy. My predominant interest is actually in climate change and some of the other sustainability issues. And when we talk about this, the embodied energy is particularly important to take into consideration. So my stainless steel triple-walled insulated mug has many, many, many more times embodied energy in the steel, what manufacturing that it took to actually produce that, and then the transportation to get it there, than this styrofoam piece. And I'll pass this around. I'll ask you to be delicate, but it's a styrofoam cup that was from Crescent Beach that a friend's father picked up for me about 10 years ago. It's got barnacles and oysters on it that I've had aged at about 3 years of age. And it's tough to tell. I've had this about 10 years now, but we tried to identify where it came from. We think it's actually a Little Champ cup. For those that remember that convenience store, the business is long gone, but their styrofoam cup is still here. So when we think about and when we see as consumers some of these issues, these are the things that come into our mind, but I think we'll get into a deeper conversation here about how bad is that compared to some of the other issues that we've got, and what energy do we put into that versus other things as well. So thank you, I'll leave it with that right now. Perfect timing.
Good evening. My name is Joel Islam. I'm president of Florida Food Service. For those of you who don't know, we're a food service distributor located in Gainesville since 1948. We sell a full line of products. This initiative, the Gainesville City Zero Waste Initiative, would potentially ban. We also sell all the other products that would be considered environmentally friendly alternatives to these products. I'm not here to advocate for or against the initiative. I just want to say that up front. And I'm not here to represent any particular individual, group, or business. I would like to share some of the concerns of those whom I've discussed this initiative with, mainly our customers. I've spoken with numerous restaurant owners and have yet to find anyone who is opposed to finding out more about reducing waste, what that means for their business, and how that helps the city accomplish its goal of reduced waste and reduced impact on the environment. I'm also aware that the Chamber has adopted a position of support for a data-driven zero-waste movement supported by engaged, educated, and collaborative community. So that's important to know that you have a lot of buy-in from the business community, I believe. Every restaurant owner I have spoken to is concerned about the environment and issues related to sustainability. They are also concerned about adding cost to their business. The owners agreed a great outcome of this initiative would be if they spend no extra money, or even a little extra money, and gain a large benefit in terms of waste reduction or environmental impact. They also agree, and I think everybody here would agree, that a very bad outcome would be if they spend a lot of extra money and actually increase the waste problem in our community. And I don't think anybody thinks that's going to happen. A frequent concern I have heard from some restaurant owners is how this initiative will affect the quality of the food products they are providing. For example, the owner of a smoothie business is concerned about potential customer complaints and loss of business if the frozen product melts too quickly. Another concern is that many restaurant owners have inventories of pre-printed and logo cups and containers, and it's not uncommon for that inventory to last 12 to 18 months. Again, I have not spoken to anyone who is opposed to this initiative. They simply want to know the costs and benefits before this becomes mandatory. There is a lot of fear, and knowledge is the antidote for that fear. And I was asked to bring some data, so I want to share with you some numbers. For our business, we're considered a broadline food distributor. For our business, the amount of products impacted by a potential ban would be about 1.5%. The foam, basically the foam products. Of those products, 20 items represent 75% of all the foam. So you're not talking about a lot of items. One customer that I looked at, just to share some more numbers with you, to make a move from foam to paper would cost them about $10,000 per year. That's a local business. For that customer, their current cost of foam is about 3% of their business, 3% of the food cost. And the move would make it up more than 10% of their food cost. So I just wanted to share some of those numbers with you to give you some scale of what a local business owner might be thinking as they consider what their alternatives may be. Thank you.
So to get us started, Tim mentioned life cycle analysis. And so our first question, which I can direct to him initially, is to define and compare the life cycle analysis of plastics, paper, and other materials used for single-use containers, such as compostable items.
Okay, so the idea, just real quick, behind a life cycle analysis, or you'll hear it as a life cycle assessment, is what you try to do is you try to track, you know, a material or a product or a process from its very beginning to its very end. So if we think about, let's think about a polystyrene cup here, for example. That would be from the extraction of what? The petroleum, right? Because ultimately it's a fossil fuel based product. It would have to be then converted into an expanded polystyrene resin, and that would go to a manufacturer who would eventually make a cup. That cup, and of course, all along the way there's transportation associated with some of that. That cup would then go to a distributor or some other entity like that, eventually go to a restaurant or whatever other store might use that. Customer comes and takes that cup, fills it up, takes it with them, then eventually has a point when they have to discard that cup, they have to do something with it. Probably nearly all such cups in Alachua County are going to go in the trash can. That's not something that's a very commonly recycled item. There are a few places around the country that might try to recycle polystyrene here or there, but it's not really a common thing, and couldn't find a good market for that in Florida these days at all. So it's going to go. If it goes in the trash can in Alachua County, it goes to the transfer station, it goes to the landfill. Okay. Once it goes to the transfer station, they may pull out an automobile tire that's not supposed to go to a landfill, or a container of paint that's not supposed to go to a landfill. But don't get the idea that a lot of people are putting their hands on the garbage at that point. Really, once it goes in your trash can, it's going to be emptied on the floor of the transfer station, in the back of a truck. It's going to be driven out to New River in Union County. It's going to be unloaded, and then it's going to be compacted. Of course, New River Landfill is a very modern, progressive, protective facility But for the most part, that polystyrene plastic is going to end up in that landfill. And you can find things online that say it'll degrade in 500 years or 1,000 years. But for our purposes, it doesn't degrade. Okay, plastics, unless they're designed to be biodegradable, don't biodegrade. So it's sitting in the landfill. And then it just stays there. Now, if we were in another county, it might go to a waste energy plant and be burned, and you can get some energy out of it. But in Alachua, it's going to go into the landfill. Now, if we go back and talk about one of these paper cups, for example, you know, coated with plastic or wax or whatever, same process. You know, you're going to harvest the wood from a tree, perhaps some recycled material going into that. Ultimately, you manufacture that paper cup, kind of the same process we talked about. Eventually, gets to the customer. Customer throws it away, unless, you know, they happen to be on campus and can get rid of it in one of our compostable food waste recycling containers. It's going to go in the trash can. It's going to go to the transfer station. It's going to go to the landfill. And then once it's in the landfill, if it's paper, some of it will decompose. Okay? It depends on the type of paper. It depends on how the landfills operate. New River actually operates pretty well in terms of trying to make things decompose. That doesn't mean that all of it disappears. That just means some piece of that cup will turn into landfill gas, which is methane and carbon dioxide. And New River is in the process of trying to take that methane and either burn it or they're going to make electricity out of it. And if it doesn't turn, the rest of it just stays there in the landfill. So if we look at that life cycle, then we have the ability to track. Now, if it goes into the bin on campus, it'll go out to the Watson's facility, and they'll put it in a big windrow with some other materials and some yard trash and some tomatoes and whatever else is left over. That'll get all composted. And when you're done, for the most part, you're going to have what compost looks like. Okay, and then that's going to be distributed around. But it takes energy to make that compost. You actually have to drive a piece of machinery, and you have to turn it, and you have to transport it, and things like that. So what scientists have done around the world is they've done these life cycle assessments. And they literally track all the energy associated with every one of those steps. Or they track the amount of CO2 that's emitted from every one of those steps. Or you can do it for water consumption or emission of a toxic chemical. And then what you do is you come up with this overall life cycle assessment. And depending on how it's managed in terms of whether it goes to the landfill or waste energy plant or goes to a recycling facility, you'll get some kind of number. And it also depends on a lot of other things we don't have time to go into. But the bottom line is we now have the ability to quantify some of that. I went through and I looked online, both kind of the papers that scientists and professors publish. Some of these studies are by industry groups, so you know, they're supposed to be scientific and unbiased, but you know, you'd have to go and read and kind of judge for yourself. Kind of the bottom line is, and this may be something that others can jump off, when I went through and reviewed everything, if you put aside putting it in a landfill and what happens to it then, whether it decomposes or not, there's no definite answer one way or another with respect to if I switch from this type of cup to another type of cup with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. And with respect to energy, that there's a huge difference. If you're just switching from one to another. Now, if you're switching from a cup and you're reusing this, and you reuse that enough time, absolutely. If you don't produce that cup anymore, there's a savings. But if you're just switching from one cup to another, I would say the literature out there right now suggests, or from one bag type to another bag type, the literature right now suggests, at least from a greenhouse gas emission perspective, from a energy perspective, there's not necessarily a huge difference. And you know, the studies vary. And if you were on one side or the other, you could probably find one study to support one side versus another. But the bottom line is that if you're just switching from one material to another, not a huge difference. If, however, you ban the plastic bag and then you go into the grocery store and use your own cloth bag or reusable bag and you do that enough times, then absolutely, you've offset using that bag. And so all the energy and emissions associated with using that bag works. It just depends on whether or not the consumer stops using bags or whether they use a different kind of bag. So again, that's not work research I've done. That's just kind of my perusal of the literature, both for bags and polystyrene cups. Now, what that doesn't consider, though, is that doesn't consider, you know, terrestrial or marine debris, whether you're talking about getting into lakes or oceans or things like that. And clearly, if lots of bags from Alachua County and cups from Alachua County were getting into water bodies or into whatever sensitive environments there would be, then that certainly would be something that would be a concern. And if you banned it from a life cycle perspective, if that was your endpoint and your concern, then there would be a benefit. Just remember, most of the plastic that gets disposed of is going to a landfill. And for the most part, there's not huge amounts of litter from that. It's going to be people who are out there and for some reason have it blown out the back of their pickup truck or not handling it or thrown on the ground. And what fraction of that is compared to the overall amount, I don't know that we really have a good handle on. But anyway, kind of to summarize from a life cycle perspective, what's in the scientific literature, there's not one big conclusion that says, if you're talking about CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, or energy or water consumption, that there's a huge benefit of one material versus another. If all you're doing is replacing one versus another, the literature suggests it's about the same. But there are other endpoints, like marine debris and aquatic debris, and that's not typically considered as part of that. So you'd have to judge whether or not that was something that was the big driver. And if that is the big driver, then that doesn't mean that these studies particularly hold a lot of water one way or another. So hope that helps some.
Do any of the other panelists have something to add to the life cycle analysis?
No. Just kind of the end of what he said there, and I think that's a very good point, is that it does depend on what you're looking at and what is the important effect from this. And one of those things, like the effects are the like land use planning and with the issue of trash and other things leaving landfills versus it being deposited on the street or something like that, that's an important thing to consider, because instead of banning those things, it may be more just an improvement of landfill practice, if that's what is needed, or if it's, you know, another way of gathering up that waste instead. And so that's just something to consider.
Just very quickly, there's an old PhD study, probably about 15 years old now, that kind of boils it down into terms that everybody can generally think about, but the sort of white ceramic diner coffee mug that everybody thinks about versus styrofoam. So when this student did his PhD and did this analysis, the total life cycle impact was that you have to keep that mug in circulation for 3 years in order to break even with polystyrene. And that includes the heat for heating the water up, all of the water, the transportation costs. And so one of the questions was, what's your droppage rate in your restaurant? You know, how often do you hear those things drop and smash? And that goes to that embodied energy component as well. I'm assuming that there have been some subsequent studies since that point in time, but that's sort of the general rule of thumb. And just as an example, on campus now, we've got our new students coming in through preview. They are getting 7 different water bottles right now. To be able to use it, because everybody thinks they're the coolest thing to give to students as the giveaway. But if they don't keep those water bottles or those coffee cups in use for X amount of years, then you're not actually getting the benefit, and it overall is a worse sort of an impact environmentally.
Does that mean that on UF campus you can't get a disposable water bottle?
You can. Pepsi's made sure of that.
What was that question?
I asked if at UF you cannot get a disposable water bottle. And he said that yes, per Pepsi you can.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I want to give Commissioner Harvey Ward a chance to provide some opening comments as well.
Thank you, Nina. Thank you all for being here. It's great to see such a good crowd out tonight to hear about this. It's nice to be on the panel with a whole lot of people who know a whole lot more than I do about this. But I will... If I can, I just want to catch you up on what the city of Gainesville is actually doing, because I think there's some misunderstanding about what's actually happening right now and why. About 3 or 4 months ago, at a general policy committee meeting, not an actual commission meeting, but a general policy committee meeting, which is a less formal, less binding sort of thing, we discussed the idea of banning expanded polystyrene, styrofoam, and single-use plastic bags in the city of Gainesville. We chose not to start a ban moving forward at that point, but we did unanimously agree that, yes, that's something that we are very likely to do within, from that point, 12 to 18 months. So at this point, we're probably looking at about a year before we take action that will be binding to do that, all other things being equal. The reason that we kind of slowed down on it and thought that right then was not the right time to do it is because a couple of local business owners were there and made a very strong case that they needed some time to prepare for this. Sandwich Inn was there, and the folks from Lucy's were there, and they made a great case that They didn't disagree with the idea, they just needed some time to get ready for it and see what to do instead of styrofoam. Because there's no question that it does have a major impact to some businesses to ban the use of styrofoam and single-use plastic bags. There's also no question, no matter how you look at data, that we're going to end up having to ban those things in general as a society. The question is, when are we going to have to do that? And we think in Gainesville it's probably going to be about a year. We want to give folks an opportunity to make other plans. We want to try to figure out what is the best alternative to those for businesses and for home use. Because the truth is, it's going to be inconvenient for all of us. We all like a nice cold Coke at the end of the day. You know, you drive through and you get it in a styrofoam cup and it stays cold till you get home, until you get to the office. You take it out of the work site, it stays cold. It's great. But it never goes away. You know, from our perspective, from what the city of Gainesville is looking at, we're not talking about the long-term energy use or the emissions. Our concern at this point is, how do we stop using this stuff? How do we keep it from piling up in our creeks and all over and flowing into our rivers and flowing into the sea, where there's no question it creates an enormous problem? I haven't met a scientist yet that thinks that it's a good idea to keep using that stuff.
You got one here?
You think it's a good idea?
Yep. And I'm part of I'm a PhD in chemistry.
Fair enough.
Glad to have a discussion anytime, anywhere.
Love to have you come talk to the commission about it sometime.
And we have to recycle, and we have to recycle things. If you read the literature,
if you don't mind, you'll have a chance. So I've met one scientist so far out of several hundred who believes that to be the case. I don't think that I am not a scientist. I don't think you have to be a scientist. My urging would be that you take the polystyrene that you use, take the styrofoam that you may still be using, stack it up on your back porch, and see how quickly it stacks up, and then ask yourself, what's going to happen to this eventually? And the truth is that when you walk down to your local creek, which we are loaded with in Gainesville, we are blessed with in Gainesville, you will see somebody's styrofoam plate float by if you stand there for about a minute and a half. And it's going to go from there into the river into, you know, to clog up the aquifer or to go into the ocean. We know that. I can't tell my children, this is your problem, not mine. I'm not going to tell them that. There are better alternatives. I don't know what the best alternative is. I really don't. We are trying, as a city and a county, to come up with a list of better alternatives to give to businesses to say, here's what might work best. But for now, within the next year or so, I think you're going to see the Gainesville City Commission ban styrofoam or expanded polystyrene and single-use plastic bags in the city limits. So. There is no ordinance right now, so if you ask me specifically what's in the ordinance, I can't tell you because it doesn't exist yet. That's going to be a lot more discussion with our legal staff and with folks throughout the community before we get to a point where there is an ordinance that's going to be passed. But I can tell you, in principle, that's what's coming. So if you have a financial stake in trying to choose something different, now's the time to be working on it, because that is coming down the road. But I do appreciate the business community coming to us and saying, hey, this is problematic. Please give us a little time to work on this. And that's exactly what we're in the process of doing right now. So again, thank you all for being here.
So we've talked a bit about bans, but these are also an option for local governments and have been passed elsewhere. So I was wondering if one of the panelists would like to speak a little bit to bans versus fees and pros and cons to either of those.
So I have no experience with either of them, but I'm going to speak about it anyway. my general impression is that when we work with sustainability, a lot of it is about coming together from a variety of different positions and opinions. And when you start to bring up the word ban, you immediately create two sides to the issue, and it immediately gets fairly contentious. My personal preference is for fees. Joel did a really nice job of talking about what the cost increase would be to the businesses that they work with and some of their concerns. It's sort of a standard thing that I use in classes all the time is that waste is really difficult for us because we're doing the cheapest, worst thing possible right now. So it's almost impossible to get something that's better for an equal cost or less, would be my guess, because we're already doing something really bad with it, and it's going to take more. Most people don't want to talk about increased cost for waste. When you think about it from a business standpoint, when you even think about it from a personal standpoint, that's trash. That should take up less than 0.5% of your day. You're supposed to be focusing on other things, but at the same time, we do because it's important. So when we talk about the fee, my perspective on that is that that is the end-of-life cost of what the impact of that item is likely to be. So in order for the county or for anybody else to deal with litter cleanups that don't rely on volunteers, to be able to dispose of things properly, you need that fee up front. And so from an example from a university perspective, many campuses are looking at the possibility of seeing whether they can apply with their purchasing a waste disposal fee at the very beginning. Because that's also the other issue with waste, is that there's frequently a very long time between purchase and disposal, and how do you recoup a cost between those two things? Now, it works at a university scale. It may or may not work for a small individual business kind of a scale as well. But my personal perspective is that that's a way that you fund this thing that is likely going to cost us more in order to do some of the right things with it, even though it may not be the perfect thing that we're looking at that particular point in time. And I know that in the current last decade or so, when you start talking about fee, immediately one group of the community will start talking about that as a tax, and that term immediately turns it toxic. But I think when we talk about this is the cost of the impact of what you are doing with your product, when you bring it back to personal responsibility, this is the responsibility of the business owner to take responsibility for the actions that they've created an issue in delivering their product.
Can I add to that?
Yeah.
So along those lines, just to share with you what a few other places have done to sort of get participation in what would be a voluntary manner from the businesses. Nashville partnered with restaurants and the National Resources Defense Council to do a food saver challenge. They called on restaurants to reuse what they could, donate leftover food, and send their scraps to be composted. The 55 participating businesses chose 5 sustainability measures to commit to over a 3-month period. And since the food saver challenge, the Country Music Hall of Fame has seen a 24% reduction in trash and has increased its recycling and food donations, as well as composting. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania made the creation of a public-private partnership a precursor to actually developing a strategy. Today they have about 40 corporate and business partners and provide extensive public education and recycling resources. They host community events, contests centered around the collection of recyclable waste. They also incentivize and reward participation. Fort Worth, Texas, the city is responsible for planning the management of the solid waste. So the material is all collected, processed, and disposed of by a network of public contracts and private service providers, and therefore reducing the environmental impact associated with the solid waste. There's some pretty creative ideas out there, and I think we can all come up with some good solutions.
I wanted to allow other panelists to talk a little bit more about fees versus bans, if you had anything to add. So we've talked about the environmental impacts, and I wanted to give the opportunity to explore that a little bit more. So between what happens downstream and then also with the greenhouse gas emissions. So I was hoping that one of our panelists can speak to that a little bit more.
And she's looking at you, Tim.
She's not looking at me.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I'm tempted to see if anybody has any questions with regard to that, because, again, if you can think about the greenhouse gas emissions, for example, upstream, meaning that all the energy that went into making the product in the first place, and then you could think about what it is once you dispose of it or recycle it somehow. And again, So I've seen, you know, in looking through the literature in terms of the energy associated with it and the CO2 associated with it, I've seen, you know, one study said that it takes more energy or more CO2 is released when you have a paper bag versus a plastic bag for doing the same thing. And I saw another study that said for a polystyrene container, there's a little more CO2 release, but for a paper cup that has some wax or plastic on it, there's a little more energy that it takes. And so, again, with respect to environmental impacts, I think with those type, again, not talking about the aquatic system or anything like that, the data suggests that just trading one for another isn't necessarily making a big difference. It's not using the other one. In other words, okay, if you have a fee on a bag and you choose, well, no, I'm going to bring my own bags in, that's where it begins to make a difference. Where a lot of the studies deviate is upon disposal. And so some folks consider that if you put the carbon and the plastic in the landfill, then that's a way of locking that carbon away. Or that if you put the paper cup in a landfill or the paper bag in a landfill, it's a way of locking the carbon away. But on the other hand, if it degrades in the landfill, it produces methane. And if it produces methane, well, then that's bad. But if you have a landfill gas collection system and you can collect the methane and make energy out of it, that could be good. So again, I would say that there's no one crystal clear answer one way or another for switching from one product to another product with respect to the kinds of environmental outcomes that I've been talking about, which again may not be what the environmental outcome or the outcome that you're concerned about. But with respect to those, which is kind of what we look at on a big picture for waste management, there's no tremendous difference.
And again, just like you said, it's the what is that you're considering. And just one statistic that I pulled out, at present we produce about 200 million tons of plastic per annum globally, and that requires about 8% of the world oil production. So that's a pretty large amount of oil production to go into these plastics. And we can go into a little bit more about the specific constituents, but plastics, from what is being researched about them and looked at sort of preliminarily, there is a lot of additives that are potentially being released that may not be released if you're using paper or something of that nature. So there's another just sort of contrast there that can be looked at and thought about.
Quick. Sorry, Tim. Just one more quick add-on. I'm getting paid by the minute, so I want to keep talking. One of the things that we've kind of alluded to briefly, but we haven't touched on much, though, is the environmental impacts to humans as well. And so for those that had the misfortune of seeing the panel that I was on at First Magnitude a little while ago, I do not use plastics for hot beverages at all, period. And anybody who's had coffee out of a styrofoam cup knows that flavor. You are ingesting that plasticizer. And one of the things that there's still no distinctive link between cancer and plasticizers, but that's partly because plastics really didn't start to exist until the 1950s. And most everybody in this room is of the generation that plastics are being used as an experiment on us. And so it's going to take a little bit longer before we figure out what that actually looks like in the long term. So while I've talked about some of the other impacts that are here, there are those other aspects that we haven't touched on yet as the downstream effects of some of these things too, where the science just hasn't had enough time to really be able to show yes or no.
I would like to talk a little bit more about impacts to local businesses and looking at the costs of alternatives between plastic and paper and alternative products such as compostable items. I was wondering, Joel, if you could speak a bit more to that.
Well, I didn't bring a whole lot of data. I think I shared with you pretty much what I have. I know that there's been some talk in the local community at the meeting at Lucy's about getting together and trying to reduce the impact, the cost, by combining forces and creating a buying group. And that's all well and good, but it's not very likely. I mean, the fact is, you can look at it like maybe light bulbs, you know, incandescent versus LEDs. I mean, the prices of LEDs have definitely gone down, but the price of another alternative is never going to go below the input cost to create that thing. So there are some real challenges there. And obviously, something to be considered for the restaurant. I know that with straws, and you know, if you compare plastic straws with paper straws, we sell all these things. It's about 9 times the cost.
Can I ask a question?
We'll have an opportunity for questions at the end, so I'll allow the other panelists to speak on this item.
Again, I'm not in the restaurant industry and don't sell supplies, but speaking of LED light bulbs, the truth is they cost about, at least 5 or 6 times less than they cost a few years ago, and that's an economy of scale issue. The more, now this is no, it's cold comfort to somebody who's trying to make the switch now, but the truth is over a 3, 4, 5 year period, as more communities make the switch and ban or fee or however we reduce use, you're going to see costs go down for paper straws, for instance. That's because there's going to be more production of those, and the economies of scale will kick in just like they did for LED light bulbs and for any number of other things that you can point to in society. Solar panels are another thing to point to. If something is rare, it's more expensive. The more it's produced, the less expensive it is likely to become. We all see that in everyday life, and I know that, again, that is cold comfort if you're trying to make the switch right now in your business. I get that there is a financial impact there, and we want to do whatever we can to help ease that financial impact, but I don't want to look at a grandchild one day and say, I'm sorry there's so much stuff piled up around you, but it was expensive to not do it. I don't mean that as a joke. I mean, that's reality. That's where we're headed. So we have to weigh the costs today. So.
I'll mention briefly from the university's purchasing perspective that one of the conversations we have on a regular basis is that we oftentimes think of things as the single line on the Excel sheet. So I think it was particularly important to see that it's 3% to 10% of a business's costs for that. The thing that we always respond with on campus is that when we look at the rest of the Excel lines in your budget, that there may be a way to show a savings there that will cover the cost of that. And so I can almost guarantee that any business that is looking at it can probably save 10 to 15% on their utility bills through energy efficiency, and that more than covers the cost of your equipment and your disposable costs. And so I think that's one of the things that is sort of always there at the case. And I'll give the example. I see there's a couple of heads shaking around. I'll give the example that the university pays $42 million a year in utility costs, which is a lot. We have an energy manager who's able to save $80,000 per building that he goes in and just tweaks the air conditioning settings. This is for a university that has lots of engineers and lots of people who have been paying attention to its utility use for a very, very long time. Almost every small-scale business can do that same thing as well.
I would also like to bring it up just to the general public and ask the question of what we can all do to reduce our own waste. Recommendations from the panelists.
At the City of Gainesville, we are in the process of just stopping buying styrofoam ourselves right now as an entity before we ban everybody else doing it. That has resulted in some interesting behaviors on the part of city commissioners. Every now and then you see somebody who is used to drinking a lot of coffee during meetings not being able to drink sometimes. What we're actually doing is just encouraging each other to bring in reusable mugs. We all have a cupboard full at home. We bring them in. One commissioner now brings in a ceramic plate to eat off of, as well as utensils from home that can be washed and washes them after every use. We're headed to a marginally less convenient future, but it's one that pays great dividends for us. So what we do at my office is we've started just using things that we can reuse.
Yeah, this is a great topic because even a lot of time, I mean, I've worked for various environmental organizations and companies that are doing environmental work that had no recycling plan and no, didn't use these alternative products. And so that is something that is, and I've seen a lot, that it's interesting people that maybe working on this work on a kind of a daily basis may not sort of know how to implement it even for themselves sometimes. And so I think reminding, just sort of general, before events, sending out an email or a text message or something, just telling people to remind, to bring a cup. That's something that happens in our, that just happened recently with one of our statewide meetings. And at the end of it, we had, you know, there was a couple piles of plastic bottles because everybody had brought their cup. I mean, unused plastic bottles. And that was a good thing to see. And that's just kind of more, you know, that's not an agency stance or anything like that. But just as we start to think about these things more often, reminding your friends, because a lot of times people don't like to be told what to do, but just a reminder of to bring your cup or to, you know, try it at something different like that. So.
So that was a pretty big question. well, here, let me just, I'll just say a few things kind of following up what I said before. You know, the biggest, I mean, we're at a pretty serious issue, point in this country right now with respect to recycling. I don't know, Sally, it's probably as rough as it's been in, I don't know, your career, but it's certainly decades now. Markets are not as good by any means as they once were. And what we did in this country, in this state, Lachlan County was a little smarter than this, but in this zeal to recycle more, there was this big push to have bigger recycling bins and carts and put all your containers. You know how we have the orange and the blue bin here? Well, most of the state, most of the country has one bin, and they put all the recyclables in. And now they put everything in there. And so the problem is that the throwaway rates at all these recycling facilities around the country are way up. So costs have gone up. Then all of a sudden the China thing happens, and the markets are shut down, and we don't have any places for this. So I guess, you know, kind of thinking out loud here, you know, we're talking about a very specific issue today about the polystyrene and the plastic bags. And I don't mean to minimize that. That's certainly very important, and I think everybody has to weigh in on that. And it, you know, has some very specific benefits potentially with respect to the environment. But in terms of the big picture environment, the thing you have to remember is we consume so many materials in terms of the state, this country, this county. And what we need to be thinking about is not just what we do with materials when we throw them away, but our materials management in general. How do you make things last longer? How do you keep having to go buy new stuff? One of the initiatives that Sally has right now is, trust me, I'm sure all of you guys in here look like you're pretty concerned environmental citizens, but you would cry at the transfer station floor watching the things that are thrown away every day, that it's like, oh my gosh, somebody could use that, absolutely. And so one of the initiatives the county's looking at right now is, what's a way to capture that? What's a way to get out there in some of these materials that are just currently being thrown away that have a way to reuse? Because I guarantee you, from an environmental perspective, if you could reuse a vacuum cleaner and not have to put that together again, that's going to save you a heck of a lot more than recycling a whole bunch of plastic or a whole bunch of other things. And so trying to figure out how we can begin to capture some of those materials, not use as much and not throw away as much, extend those lifespans. But kind of back to another big thing is, we are going to have to, in the next 5+ years, develop our own markets. Because if we want to continue recycling, I mean, the gravy train of sending stuff across the Pacific is done, okay? And so it's a matter of us prioritizing what we can begin to recycle and reuse ourselves. And I think that's a role local government can play. The thing that I was a little concerned about is that I hope that City of Gainesville, Alachua County, doesn't stop at just polystyrene and plastic bags. Because certainly you've heard about some pretty good motivation, but there's an opportunity to step back and some big, big benefits that you can get by just better looking at the materials we manage, not just how we throw them away, but how we manage and how we pick them. And that's probably a good segue for you, Matt, to come in.
Perfect, yeah. Yeah. So we get this question an awful lot from the students on campus as well, and sort of my knee-jerk response, if I don't have a lot of time, is, what did your grandparents do? Because really and truly, this disposable nature came after the end of World War II. And people, you know, I talked with my grandparents about it, and it's amazing. Life didn't suck. You had a heavy cup that you brought with you, or you had a glass bottle that would break occasionally or something like that. But there are things that we've been able to do for generations before this, and life was not awful. But one of the other aspects, sort of, this kind of gets really large-scale philosophical, but the reason we have so much waste is that we've traded our time for our waste. That's the big trade-off that we've made here. And so one of the things we talk about with the students is that when you're looking at what your waste issue is, it may actually be more of a time management aspect. What can you do to do things that generate less waste because you're doing it yourself, or you're purchasing in bulk, or you're cooking in bulk? And that is one of those things that it doesn't go up on a top 10 list because it's about as dissatisfying an answer as you could possibly give anybody. And so that's where we've got some other little ones too. When I visit a restaurant here in town that I know serves polystyrene, I'll frequently ask them for just a sheet of foil. Almost every single kitchen in this community has foil back there, and I don't know what the cost is for them. They haven't picked up on this one yet. But, you know, just wrapping it up in a sheet of foil, and I can make my own swan with it if I want to, or most likely it's just going in my fridge, and it doesn't need to be pretty. So there are things like that that you can do where that is actually a recyclable material, depending on the markets and whether or not they can take that. It is not in this county, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, not in this county then. But it's at least something that I know doesn't have a leaching effect into the body, and it's also something that doesn't float. Because as a wildlife biologist, that is the other aspect on polystyrene that you want to be able to target as well.
Just briefly, in terms of reducing waste, I mean, the restaurant owners that I talk to would love to reduce waste, primarily food waste. There's an astounding amount of food that goes to waste, and it's a big challenge when you go to your local restaurants. They want to be able to serve you. They want to have what you want. And, you know, they're never going to have the exact amount. Every once in a while, they're going to run out. And every once in a while, they're going to have too much. And unfortunately, some of that stuff just is wasted. And then on the actual garbage side, because of the dumpster, you know, there's a lot of waste products in there. And there's some innovative packaging that's helping with that. And then lastly, cooking oil is a big thing that restaurants have to deal with. And there have been markets for that, and then the markets have gone away and come back. And so that's always a challenge to find ready markets for the waste.
I'll add one quick one, which is the biggest thing you can do for recycling is buying things with recycled content in it. That's the part that everybody misses. We put a ton of stuff in our curbside processes, but recycling, for the most part, is not a feel-good process. It's market-driven, and if you're not purchasing and creating the demand for recycled content products on the backside, it falls apart. And so that's the other side of it, is if and when you do purchase, you need to make sure that you're really pushing for that post-consumer content.
So on that line, a quick anecdote. I was at a packaging meeting with a bunch of packaging industry folks, and there was this awesome presentation about this company from California who had set up these small businesses in places like Haiti where all this plastic was going in the ocean, and they were funding people to go collect the plastic so they could get enough of it, and then they made their own resin, and they would make a specific type of bottle or container that they could then use. It was more expensive though, but this woman was there and she was literally begging all these big producers to use their material, and nobody was using it though. And so here you had this solution. So as Matt was saying, if you were to demand that you had those kind of products, now there'd be a lot of you need to demand that, but that's the way you got to make things move.
Just one or two more thoughts on that end of it. First of all, I'd like to hear more from Matt about the foil swans. When you get to
absolutely. Yep.
I had a meeting with someone from the Dignity Project yesterday. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They have for years worked on helping at-risk kids learn how to work on cars by taking donated cars and helping them learn a skill by doing that. They've expanded out to working on weed eaters and lawnmowers, things that we've come to think of, many of us, as disposable. Because if something goes wrong with your weed eater, rather than tinkering with it for an afternoon and spending 3 or 4 hours on it, you can go down to Lowe's and get another one for $100. So people tend to throw out things, the small appliances, regularly. And at the Dignity Project, and probably other places, but definitely there, they're helping kids understand how to fix those as a skill. But it also helps them understand that these things are not disposable. That just because something is broken doesn't mean it can't continue to be useful with a little effort. Now, those of us who have no mechanical inclination whatsoever, it's a waste of my time to try to figure out how to fix a weed eater. But somebody else can figure out how to do that and resell it for $75 instead of the $100 when it lows. So there are organizations that are not only working on recycling those things, but helping teenagers and kids understand that everything is not disposable just because it's cheap. So that's something to think about too.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to take a 10-minute break and come back to continue the discussion and bring in audience questions as well.
We have index cards over.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is a study, you can look it up in Google. Shows you.
So, how are you doing? Good, man. Let me finish this email.
Yep. I do
now. It has higher value than you would
say. Yeah.
I was in one of the first houses. Believe it or not, I follow this stuff like.
Are you here as a business owner or as a combination?
Well, listen, Auburn University, Auburn Polytech Company.
Alabama
Polytech.
And in my senior year, they changed it.
But we always called it Auburn.
Yep. Certainly, yeah.
We have some wonderful folks here to
do. Yeah. Okay. Yep. After that, we flow
in important presentation. Friend and I went to Gator.com and thought, well, I'll see if I can get a non-plastic straw.
Right.
So I asked them, and they actually had a more truck on. And the reason
I talked to the
restaurant, and she tells me they have to contract to provide food for the basketball campus.
Yep.
So they had disposable or recyclable.
Yep. Yep.
And so I was thinking about how much plastic you have. You know, when you're talking about athletes,
polystyrene
has a blue, and yes, it has whiteness, it has titanium dioxide,
and plasticizers.
This is polystyrene.
Oh, sorry.
There's no plasticizers in polyethylene, it's just a polyethylene.
Yep,
and then they have a strong. There's a dye in it, and it has no metals in it. It's designed to not be done in great idea. Polypropylene. They have high density polyethylene and polypropylene. You do put a plastic cipher in high density polypropylene, so you can see the
different kind of
stuff that used to be flattering.
Yeah, you can see the paper ones. Yeah.
It's not which one.
Put the dye.